Hello and welcome again to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisville, Virginia. And today is Tuesday, January the 2nd of 2018. It's the first Word Magazine of a new year. Today I want to offer some reflections on reading as a spiritual discipline. And I decided to do this Word Magazine on this topic because I was going through the process of writing a blog post on things that I read in 2017. And I look back on this, and it's actually something I've done for the past 10 years. This is the 10th year, believe it or not, that I have done this. That at the end of the year, I've looked back and tried to reflect on and remember what are the things that I read and what did I gain from them. And on my blog at jeffriddle.net, I'll have my list of 2017 books. I generally list not a top 10, but just 10 books in kind of no particular order. And it's also not the top 10 books I read that were books that were published in 2017. It's not that kind of list. A lot of times the things that I'm reading were published, you know, years ago, decades ago, even centuries ago. I do try to read a few things that are new that, you know, came out in the most recent year. But it's not that kind of list, but it's just for me personally, here are, you know, 10 books that I read. And then I try to list, you know, other sort of honorable mentions, other things that I read. And I don't know how exactly I got started with this 10 years ago. I was, you know, just trying to be serious about reading and trying to be a good steward of my time and my energy. And I think maybe that it would be helpful just to me personally to keep a record of this so that I could just have a measure to evaluate how I was doing in the discipline of reading and studying. So anyways, I was just reflecting on, again, that topic of reading as a spiritual discipline. And probably like most people who are in the ministry, most people who are pastors, I like to read. I'm a bibliophile. I like books. I like to collect books. And I like the old technology. I mean, I like the old book that you can hold in your hand. I don't like reading digital books. I don't use Kindles. I don't like to read the digital words on the screen. Sometimes if I have to get a digital PDF and read it off the screen, I will. But even then, a lot of times I'll try to print it out. I just like being able to hold the text in my hand. I like being able to take a pen or a pencil and underline things and make notes. And I know you can do that in a way digitally as well, but I just like doing it manually. I like writing and scribbling notes. And most of the books that I have, if you go to the back blank pages, that's where I write down quotations and I have cross-references and just write my own thoughts and notes. And then that becomes a very useful resource later in doing book reviews or writing articles, writing a blog post, just my own reflections. And, you know, I think generally that pastors like to read and study because this is the way that we prepare to preach and to teach. And I'm also convinced that pastors are generalists and should be generalists. It's hard for a pastor, I think, to be a scholar because in academic scholarship, there has to be a narrow focus. You have to read in one particular area and become a master, an expert in a very narrow area. And I think pastors are called to be generalists. That is, we're to take interest in lots of topics because the people with whom and to whom we're ministering, the people we're serving, have a variety of interests. And They may have a question about philosophy. They may have a question about theology. They may have a practical concern about ethics or about stewardship or about health or about science. And it's really required that ministers be generalists so that they can know a lot about a lot of topics. And sometimes we have to do research on things to be able to share that with our people if someone has a particular concern and maybe we need to learn more about it. So obviously, generally, when I say I'm a generalist, it's primarily theological works that I like to read, and particularly biblical studies works. But I do try to expand it. I try to read some politics, and in more recent years, I've tried to read more fiction. I went through a period where I just didn't have much interest in reading fiction or poetry. I just wanted to read all nonfiction. But that had been a change because I had been an English major in college, and I used to love to read fiction and poetry and things like that. And I just then lost interest in it. I wanted to read more just hardcore theology, straight up theology. But again, I've kind of come back to that, and I think it's been helpful to read some fiction and also to read poetry. I think it's helped me to express myself more cogently in preaching, teaching, and in writing. I think it's a sort of a truism that if you want to be a better writer, you have to be a better reader. And I've learned a lot by reading people who write well. And that's even true of reading non-Christians who write well. I've learned a lot about writing by reading Christopher Hitchens or by reading Joseph Epstein. They've helped me to become a better writer and a better thinker, even though they don't have a Christian worldview. Reading is something that's become very enjoyable for me. When I was younger, I used to like to watch movies and film and so forth. And really, my interest in watching movies or film has really decreased. Sometimes my children want me to watch a movie with them or watch something on Netflix, and I will because I want to spend time with them, see what they're watching. But I find myself losing interest pretty quickly in a film. I really would much rather read a book. It's not to say I don't sometimes watch films. Sometimes I do. Given the choice, I would usually rather read a book. There's just something about the word on the page. You can picture something in your own imagination, and it's just much more compelling, I think, much more interesting to think through it. I'm usually reading multiple books at any given time. I'm not somebody who just reads one book and won't go on to another till I complete the one I'm reading. I'm usually honestly reading about 20 or 30 books at a time. You know, someone might start and I might put them aside for a while because of the urgency of other things that'll press them aside, or I'll get started and I'll find out it's not as interesting or I'm not as intrigued by it as I thought I might be, and I might lay it aside and never finish it. Sometimes I read selectively. I might just get a book and just read a single chapter because I'm looking for some particular information. But again, as a discipline, I'm generally, you know, if I'm going to commit to read a book, I'm going to try to read it end to end. I'm going to try to attend to the argument. And if I do write a review of the book, I'm going to make sure it's a book that I have, you know, honored the author by trying to, read completely. If it's a published review, I'm going to try to read it end to end. Usually my goal is to read one book per week. So I try to read about 52 books a year, and sometimes I'll read more than that, sometimes less. And that's complete reading, end to end. I'll read other things. Of course, I'll read articles and again, selected chapters from different books. I'll say, in addition to just trying to like I said, consume a book a week. Sometimes it's listening to a book. And I've gotten into that more in the last couple of years. I discovered the site that's called LibriVox, and it's a kind of a volunteer a site where different people will read aloud chapters from books that are in the public domain, maybe mostly classic novels and works of fiction. And you know, it's free. You can listen to it, you know, for free online. You can download it and listen, you know, on your phone or your listening device. And so, last couple of years, I've really began to listen to, and it's been kind of neat. I've listened to a lot of novels and things that I maybe always wanted to read or I had read a long time ago. Sometimes it's re-listening to something I had read a long time back. And that's been a good way to reconnect. It's not the same as reading a book, definitely. Reading it, I think looking, you know, visually at the printed word is preferable. But, you know, sometimes listening to a book when you're traveling from point A to point B, or you're doing some other kind of labor that allows you to listen to something while you do it, I found that's really been helpful. So anyways, for 10 years, I've made a list, and I've done one again this year. I'm going to post it to jeffriddle.net. And I don't do this because I'm trying to impress anyone, and there aren't that many people who read my blog anyway. There aren't that many people even listen to this podcast. I really do make the list up each year because it's really about my own personal growth. It's sort of my personal journal. It's also the blog and the articles that are on it, and including the reading lists. You know, it's there to be a resource for me personally, to be a resource for also for my ministry. This is why I do a lot of posts where I put quotes from books or reflections on them. And that a lot of times, you know, I can go back, I can search my own blog to find a quotation to use in a sermon or use in a teaching or use in an article. And so I found that to be just, again, a personal resource to put this on my blog with other things. And the podcast, Word Magazine, is sort of becoming like that as well. Aside from the benefit that it is to me personally, I do hope it can be a benefit to other people, that maybe it might spur other people on in pursuing reading as a spiritual discipline as well. Obviously, the first thing that we should be committed to reading are the scriptures, the inspired word of God. But I also think it's helpful, obviously, to read uninspired writings and even to read writings from non-Christians. I got into a conversation actually on New Year's Day. I had a minister friend and his family came over and had lunch with my family. And we got into a discussion after lunch on this very thing about the value and the pitfalls of reading secular literature. And my friend was saying, we could talk about how, and he used the term common grace. We had a discussion about whether common grace is the appropriate term, but by common grace, there are things that non-Christians say. But he also made the point we should be aware of what he called the common curse that's also there, that non-Christians may be able intuitively to write some things that are spiritually accurate in their observations of the world, but they also bear the common curse, as we all do, and so that sometimes their views of things are warped or distorted, and we have to keep that in mind as well. And we were also talking about, you know, what should a Christian read? And I do think we have to be careful. We don't need to take what my friend called as the neo-Kuyperian view, or that goes into sort of antinomianism. You know, I can read anything I want. It's not going to affect me spiritually. It's not going to affect my personal holiness. And I think we do have to be careful in reading secular literature. I think we should be reading more Christian literature. We should be reading things that contribute to our godliness and holiness. And yet, I also think for purposes of evangelism, apologetics, it is important to read non-Christians. Again, just to be a better preacher, teacher, we have to understand what people in the world are thinking. Paul, for example, often, quotes Greek philosophers. It doesn't mean he's embracing or advocating everything that they believe, but he shows an awareness of the world in which he lives, and I think that's to some degree a justification for Christians, and particularly Christian pastors and ministers, to read widely. I'm going to review the post that I am putting up today, noting the 10 highlights and some of the other things that I read. But before I do that, this same friend who was at my house on New Year's Day gave me as a gift a book, knowing that I'd like to read. And the book he gave me is a new one, just came off the presses from Banner of Truth. It's by Sinclair Ferguson. It's titled Some Pastors and Teachers, subtitle Reflecting a Biblical Vision of What Every Minister is Called to Be. This is 2017 from Banner of Truth. And it's an anthology of different articles that Sinclair Ferguson has written over the course of his ministry on the subject of ministers and ministry. And I was just reading this morning the preface or the introduction, and on page Roman numeral 12, he says, "There is no doubt that the wider reflection, study, and stretching involved can only strengthen and enrich long-term ministry. Such strengthening produces growth. Sometimes ministers can waste the privileged time they have by studying only in relation to their next sermon. This does produce some growth, of course, but perhaps not growth that is constantly putting down deeper roots and producing richer fruit. Preachers need to be reading and studying more widely and reflecting theologically, if that is to be the case, for only then will our ongoing ministry be deepened and enriched," end quote. So I thought it was timely to read that on the very day when I was jotting down my notes on my reading reflections from the past year. So I introduced the list this year with two quotes. One is a Latin quote from Seneca, "Otium sine literis mors est," which could be translated, "Leisure without letters or without books is death." And I put that up there because I teach my younger boys Latin from Wheelock's Latin, and I meet with them once a week, and we have a phrase of the day or a phrase of the week, and this was one of our phrases from last year, Latin epigram that we have memorized. "Otium sine literis mors est," leisure without books is death. And both of my sons love to read, and one of them in particular always has a book with him, and whenever we travel from point A to point B, he carries a book along. And sometimes when I see him in the back with a book, I will quote this to him from Seneca, and we'll get a chuckle over it. And then the second quote from 2 Timothy 4:13, when Paul writes to Timothy, and he says, "When thou comest, bring with thee the books." And so Paul was someone who apparently was devoted to the spiritual discipline of reading. And not only, I think, was he reading the scriptures, but he was also reading other books, uninspired books, I think, to aid him in his ministry. So again, this year, and by the way, I keep just a little notebook, and when I complete a book, I write the pertinent information down, the author and the publisher and the year published, a number of pages, and then I sit down at the end of the year, go through, and I say, okay, let me pick out 10 of these that I can do a little bit of a kind of an annotated bibliography. And so the 10 books I chose this year in no particular order. First of all, I read last year William R. Farmer's book, The Last 12 Verses of Mark, published in 1974 by Cambridge University Press. And a lot of people know William Farmer. He taught at Southern Methodist University for years. He's best known because he challenged the idea of what was called Markan priority, the idea that Mark was the earliest of the so-called synoptic gospels. That is pretty much the reigning theory in scholarship even to this day. But Farmer challenged that. He revived an old theory put forward by a 19th century German critic named Griesbach that argued for the Matthean priority, the priority of Matthew, which had been sort of the ancient position of the church. Augustine held this view that Matthew was the oldest gospel. And he wasn't successful in sort of converting the academy to the position, but he did show that the idea of Markan priority is merely a theory and cannot be proved conclusively. And so he's someone who's willing to kick a sacred cow, basically. And he does the same in this little book, where he makes a very high-level scholarly argument, though in a succinctly in a relatively small space. The book's only 124 pages long. But he basically shows that the so-called scholarly consensus that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is not original to the Gospel of Mark stands on pretty shaky ground. And so I found this book to be helpful. I ended up writing an article that's going to be coming out in the next issue of Puritan Reform Journal on the ending of Mark as a canonical crisis. And I drew pretty heavily on William Farmer's book. So that was a good book. A second book I listed was George Orwell's classic novel, dystopian novel, 1984. I had been reading some Orwell. I read his collection of essays last year, and I had read Animal Farm, and I read 1984. Of course, I'd read this way back. I remember when I was in middle school, the high school that was connected to the middle school that I attended. They put on 1984 as a play, and they came over to the middle school and performed it. And that was my introduction to seeing 1984. It made a big impact on me. I remember there was the scene where the board dropped to reveal Big Brother watching, and it was kind of jarring to see that even when I was in the eighth grade. I remember that. So this novel is a classic. Interestingly enough, when Trump came into office, there were a lot of liberals who were saying, we need to start reading 1984. It's going to be another totalitarian state. But if you read the book, you realize that Orwell, who was a left-leaning and a socialist himself, was actually writing this as a critique of his fellow socialists. And in 1984, the vision is of a totalitarian socialist state. And so it's really an intriguing book. I was really struck by the scenes where there is the stress on the erasure of history as the protagonist is sitting there and taking newspaper articles and destroying them and replacing them with fabricated stories. It's the original fake news. And also just the attempt to erase a society's history. I thought about this with regard to the recent efforts to take down monuments to those of the historical past, whether those are Confederate generals like Robert E. Lee, or founding fathers like Jefferson or Washington, and of course all the things that happened in Charlottesville over the past year. I think it's actually really intriguing to read George Orwell's 1984. And Orwell is such a good writer. Again, he's one you can learn so much from, even though he's not a Christian. but from his ability to wield the pen and to write effectively and think effectively. Along those lines, the third book that I listed was Christopher Hitchens' book, which was his memoir, Hitch 22, a memoir that was published originally in 2010. And I had also been reading over the past couple of years quite a few things from Hitchens. I read his book on Mother Teresa called The Missionary Position. I had read his collection of essays called And Yet. And I'm reading another collection of his essays right now that I hope maybe I'll complete in this year. And, you know, Hitchens is also one, you know, you can, you know, listen to some of his debates on YouTube. I love his debate with David Berlinski on religion. And again, he was very witty, very irreverent. He was really an anti-theist. He wrote the book that was a New York Times bestseller, God is Not Great. And you might say, well, what good is it to read him? I think we can learn a lot, though, from him. He's a penetrating thinker. He gives penetrating insights into the world, even though he's not a Christian. But then in the end, I think he also sort of reminds us, particularly when you look at the pathos at the end of his life and he's dealing with cancer and he's going the way of all flesh. It's just a reminder that, you know, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, that life is meaningless apart from Christ. You know, he should be read, you know, with that sort of caveat. But I think it's still useful for mature Christians to read non-Christians to learn, you know, what they think about, how they see the world. The fourth book that I listed on my 10 books from last year was Robert Louis Stevenson's classic novel, Kidnapped, originally written in 1886. And I usually try to read, include some things on the list that I read with my children. We often, after we have supper, try to have supper together, and we usually do our family devotions after supper. We read some scripture and we work a little bit on the catechism and we'll read a devotional book. We have used the books edited by Joel Beakey, Building on the Rock, the Building on the Rock series. Then after that, we often will take a novel, a classic novel, and read part of it. We've read other things as well. Sometimes we've read just some Christian devotional books. But we read Kidnapped. And my boys, younger boys, were very interested in this book and sort of enthralled by it. The language and the affect of the Scottish brogues was sometimes hard to read, but we made it through it. And I cited here the extended title that appeared in the edition that we had, and I read it every single time we would read a chapter or part of a chapter. Kidnapped, being memoirs of the adventures of David Balfour in the year 1751, how he was kidnapped and cast away, his sufferings in a desert isle, his journey into the wild highlands, his acquaintance with Alan Breck Stewart and other notorious Highland Jacobites, with all he suffered at the hands of his uncle, Ebenezer Balfour of Shaws, falsely so-called, written by himself and now set forth by Robert Louis Stevenson. And so we enjoyed reading that. Now, this edition also has some really striking, as many old books, that the book was published in 1940, the edition we used, and it has these beautiful full-color illustrations of different scenes from the novel, and we enjoyed looking at those. And of course, if I got reading through a chapter and get to an illustration, I'll stop and open it up and show it to everyone. So we enjoyed doing that together. The fifth book that I listed that I read last year was Robert Lethem's book, Through Western Eyes, Eastern Orthodoxy, A Reform Perspective, published by Mentor, again, 2007. Letham is a Presbyterian pastor and scholar, very able, systematic theologian, written a great book on the Trinity, written a great book on recently with on union with Christ. This little gem, though, is his analysis of Eastern Orthodoxy. And I read this in preparation because my daughter was living in Ukraine, and my wife and I went to visit her in August, and I knew I was going to be visiting some Eastern Orthodox churches, and I was going to be in Eastern Orthodox culture, and I wanted to understand Eastern Orthodoxy a little bit better. And it really was very helpful to read that book. Letham, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, makes the point that Eastern Orthodoxy is a part of the larger Christian tradition that never experienced a Reformation. There wasn't a Protestant Reformation in Eastern Orthodoxy the way there was in the Western Church. Nor was it ever touched in the same way that the West was by the Enlightenment. He presents quite a sympathetic. In fact, there were several places I was reading, I was like, he's being too sympathetic. But he also was very clear in tracing some of the Protestant objections to Eastern Orthodoxy. I found it to be a very, very helpful book, helped me understand it, and it was very useful before I went over to really appreciate a lot of things I saw and experienced while I was there. The sixth book I listed is Boonsing Po's little self-published book, The Fundamentals of Our Faith, Studies on the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith. And this was one of the books I read that was published last year. It was published in 2017. I've actually written a review of this book, and I hope it's going to show up in a future edition of the Puritan Reformed Journal. This was a special book for a couple of reasons. For one thing, Pastor Poe and his wife Goody came to the U.S. Of course, he's a pastor in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and I was in his church in 2015 preaching in a minister's conference, and we were able to return the invitation. He came and preached at our 2017 Keech Conference, which was held at Warrenton at the Covenant Reformed Baptist Church. And then he came and spent a week with my family, and he spoke in a number of venues, preached in our church. And this little book is sort of a more of an individual or a group study through the 1689 Confession. So there were actually a lot of things he wrote about we were able to talk about. And it was also helpful because I'm in a series preaching through the Second London Confession in the afternoon services at our church. And so I found this little book to be helpful. And again, the review of this will be coming out. And once it is published, I'll probably do an audio version of it, and we'll put it on Sermon Audio so you can read the fuller review of it. The seventh book that I listed in the 10 highlights from 2017 was the classic Banner of Truth reprint commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes from Charles Bridges. The original was published in 1800. And I completed earlier in 2017 a sermon series through Ecclesiastes. I'd started it in 2016 and then finished it in the first half of 2017. And I read through this commentary sort of passage by passage as I preached through Ecclesiastes, and it's just a wonderful book. Does it provide good scholarly insights as to, you know, the historical literary aspects of Ecclesiastes, but really more importantly, it does what I think really only the old commentaries are able to do. That is, it's a devotional work. It's a work of piety. It's a work of spirituality, and you just don't find this in modern commentaries. When I preach through a book, I usually try to read an older commentary and a newer commentary. Here lately, I've just forgotten. I've just left off reading the newer commentaries and just read the older ones. So I'm preaching through John right now, and I'm just reading Calvin's commentary and Matthew Poole sometimes, and Matthew Henry. But anyways, Bridges' commentary is highly recommended. The eighth book I listed here is one written by Ibn Warraq, Why I Am Not a Muslim. Again, this is an older book. It was first published in 1995, then reprinted in 2003. And Ibn Warraq is a Pakistani dissident intellectual who now lives in the UK. Ibn Warraq is not his actual name. It's a pseudonym. Ibn Warraq apparently means son of a papermaker, and he writes under this nom de plume. It's his story of his apostasy, basically, from Islam, why he rejects Islam. Unfortunately, he is an atheist, and I note in my little blurb here, I kind of have the same wonder with Ibn Warraq that I have with Ayan Hirsi Ali, who's another former Muslim whose writings I really enjoy. Her memoirs are fascinating, but you kind of wish, if only this person had been able to have encountered a winsome, intelligent view of Christianity, and if only they had encountered a winsome advocacy of biblical Christianity. You wondered if they might have embraced it. But so a lot of the critiques he has of Islam from sort of a naturalistic standpoint could certainly be applied to Christianity, rejecting miracles and the supernatural and so forth. But so we can't endorse everything in it in that regard. But it is a very helpful book for understanding, I think, Islam as it truly is practiced, written by someone who grew up within Islam and understands it very well. It's a very scholarly book. It's loaded with information, loaded with footnotes. It's not a quick read. It takes time. It takes diligence to really read it and understand it. I found it to be very, very helpful for understanding Islam from an insider's sort of viewpoint. The ninth book, somewhat related on my list, is Irving Hexham's book, Understanding World Religions and Interdisciplinary Approach, published by Zondervan in 2011. This is a textbook. This is a big book, 512 pages. I used this book as a textbook for a class I taught last semester, fall of 2017, college level course titled Religions of the World. And I was looking for a textbook. I saw this one and got it, ordered it, and read it. Hexham is a Christian scholar, but he teaches in a secular university, the University of Calgary in Canada. From reading the book, although he presents the book sort of, it's not really a Christian book per se, although he tells you what his presuppositions are, and he tells you that he is an evangelical Christian. But he doesn't, make a lot of judgments about the religions. It's more descriptive of the religions that he covers in the book. But you can tell from the writing, first of all, that he is a continuationist. Also, there are some things in the book where he sort of has a more liberal, progressive view on some things that I wouldn't be completely comfortable with. But all in all, I found this to be a very good book. I found it to be very helpful. I learned a lot about various world religions myself. He is especially an expert in African religions. I think he spent some time in South Africa. And I thought this was intriguing, especially he spent some time talking about the African initiated religions that blend Christianity and Islam. And I this was something I really wasn't very aware of, but I'm much more aware of it now, having read the book. And I would commend it. The 10th and last book on my list, I put a work of fiction on here. This is one that I didn't read, but one that I listened to on LibriVox. And it's one I long wanted to read. And this was also something I listened to this summer in preparation of going over to Ukraine, although Ukraine obviously is Ukrainian, but obviously it used to be part of the Soviet Union, and there are lots of people still who speak Russian, and it's a Russian influence. It's in the Russo sphere, I guess we could call it. So I listened to Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, and on LibriVox there is a chapter-by-chapter reading of this. It's from the translation, and I did a little digging and also discovered that, you know, many of Dostoevsky's works, and I think some other Russian language works, were translated by an English woman named Constance Garnett in the late 19th, early 20th century. This one was translated by her in 1912. And as I understand it, this translation is now thought to be somewhat suspect, and there's a whole round of modern translations from the Russian into English that are being done. But this is the old one. I found it. You know, again, I wasn't reading the Russian, and can't evaluate I wasn't listening to the Russian. I was listening to her English translation. I can't evaluate the accuracy of her translation, but it was a pretty compelling a book to listen to. Again, I found it really helpful. It's a good story. It's sort of like a mystery story. There's a question about the who took the life of Fyodor Pavlovich, the father of these brothers. And it's also well known as a rich theological novel, particularly a chapter that's about the Grand Inquisitor, and there's the question of the sovereignty of God and the problem of evil. I just found it was also very helpful because there's so much Eastern Orthodox piety within it. There's a scene where the elder in the monastery, Zosima, dies, and the monks are sitting around, and he was such a pious and godly man. They're wondering if he was a saint. And they begin to smell the stench of his body as it is going into corruption. And I wasn't aware of this tradition in Eastern Orthodoxy that expects the bodies of godly men or the saints not to putrefy. And a little connection, I was reading this past semester also the book The Martyrdom of Polycarp, early Christian work, The Martyrdom of Polycarp. And there's a section in there where it talks about a sweet smelling aroma coming from the body of Polycarp after his martyrdom. And I thought about the deep roots of that are sort of reflected in the Brothers Karamazov. I watched a lecture online from a professor at University of California, Berkeley, about the Soviet era preservation of the body of Lenin and how it reflected this Eastern Orthodox view of keeping the body and preserving the body of great men, and sort of how that communism, even though it was officially atheistic, sort of took on a lot of religious overtones. So anyways, it was fascinating to read that book, particularly, or listen to that book, particularly on the eve of our trip to Ukraine. So those were the 10 highlights. And then I've listed a lot of other books. I sort of put them in categories, and these are it's not exhaustive, everything I read last year. A lot of things I read just parts of, and one things I'm working on now that'll be on the list in 2018. But I grouped it into several categories. The first category is biblical studies, text criticism, and early Christianity. And if you look at that list and you read my blog, you'll see some things that I've done blog posts on. Like I did a Word magazine on the Doug Wilson, James White debate. There's also another book on there on text and translation by Harry Friedman, The Murderous History of Bible Translations. I've written a review of that. and it'll probably show up in a Puritan Reformed journal. And when it does, I'll have an audio reading of it. And I've done quite a few blog posts on Robert Haldane's, the sprinkle reprint of his book, The Books of the Old and New Testaments, proven to be canonical. It was a very helpful book. I didn't list it in my top 10, well, might have. And I did read, in addition to Lethem's book and Dostoevsky, I did read a couple other books on Eastern Orthodoxy, including a little book by published by St. Vladimir Seminary Press called The Faith We Hold by the Finnish Eastern Orthodox Archbishop Paul. More notably, I read the thicker book by Josiah Trentum, who's a man who used to be a Presbyterian who became Eastern Orthodox, and he's written this critique of Reformed theology from an Eastern Orthodox perspective. It's a very provocative book, and I'll probably write something longer in the form of a review of it at a later time. Then under theological and pastoral studies, I read a number of books, including a couple by the Protestant Reformed Church theologians, Herman Hanko and David Ingelsma, one on the five points of Calvinism, one on the Reformed worldview. Earlier in the year, I also read the book that was getting a lot of buzz right at the beginning of the year, by Rod Dreher. I guess I should have put that in the Eastern Orthodoxy category too. The book called The Benedict Option. And this is another one that was a 2017 book. And I had meant to do a Word magazine on it. I may still do it at some point. It was getting a lot of conversation early in the year about how Christians should withdraw from the culture. And there's also another book on there that I'll probably do a Word magazine on at some time. I read last year, Peter Enns, the fellow who used to teach at Western Seminary, titled The Sin of Certainty, Why God Desires Our Trust More Than Our Correct Beliefs. And again, this is a book from a very liberal perspective. And again, I try to read wide-ranging. I'll try to read liberal things. I'll try to read conservative things, Eastern Orthodox, Reformed, even sometimes Roman Catholic. I've read atheists. I'm trying to get a wide reading, not because I don't have convictions, or not because I'm being moved by every wind of doctrine, but I'm just trying to understand better. I don't want to be ignorant, and I want to misrepresent the views of others. I thought Enns's book was very interesting, given his background and given the sort of modern milieu, this idea that, particularly with regard to text criticism, that somehow the search for certainty is wrong or even sinful. Oddly enough, you'll hear James White say the very thing that Peter Enns does in this book. I listened to some books on politics, religion, and philosophy. I've been trying to read a little more philosophy lately. I read Sam Harris's little book on free will. I've read a couple things recently by Roger Scruton, some of which I haven't yet finished, but one that I did finish was a little book written by Roger Scruton and Mark Dooley, called Conversations with Roger Scruton, and I've been intrigued by a lot of Scruton's ideas. He sort of has a Church of England background, conservative, a philosopher. He's written the book on Kant that's in the little Oxford paperback series, also the book on aesthetics, and I find him to be an intriguing thinker. I did a couple blog posts on Alvin Plantinga's book, Knowledge and Christian Belief. And I did a longer post on Gordon Clark's Religion, Reason, and Revelation. Some of those work. Then literary essays, poetry, and fiction. Again, I read a lot more fiction and poetry than I have in some years past. The very first book listed here is Adam Zagajewski's book, A Defense of Ardor. Very interesting collection of essays, although Zagajewski is a poet. He's also an essayist, and he is Polish. And one interesting thing is in that book, he talks about the fact, sort of autobiographically several times, about how his family had come from a city in Ukraine that had once been a Polish city, and then they had been pushed out I think by the I don't know, the Germans, they were forced, or the Russians were forced to relocate to Poland. And I actually get to visit that city. It's called Lviv, a beautiful city in western Ukraine. So it's kind of interesting to read that. I could have put that with the, I mean, I wouldn't have put it under the Eastern Orthodox because Zagajewski is Roman Catholic. Again, read a number of other, I read three books, poetry, brief books of poetry by David White, who is from the UK, but lives out in Washington State. I think that was also related to the trip that I made out in March of last year to Seattle to preach in a church there. And I read some of White's poetry that has a lot of themes, Western and Pacific Northwest themes to it. And then at the end there, you see not only I could have listed either of these works also instead of the Brothers Karamazov. I listened on LibriVox also to George Eliot's Middlemarch, and that is a great book to listen to. And I also listened this year to Melville's Moby Dick. So I listened to two huge books on LibriVox and thoroughly enjoyed listening to them along with some others. And then biographies, I read Mark Galley's Karl Barth, an introductory biographer, Evangelicals. I did a Word magazine on that. I've also written a review that'll probably appear in Puritan Reform Journal in 2018 on that book. And I read several others. And so, again, that's the summary of some of my reading from 2017. And I'm hoping, if the Lord will allow, I'll be able to continue to read and study in 2018, and maybe in January 1st or 2nd of 2019, I'll be able to list a reflection on the books that I read in this year. I've already got several that I'm working on. I'm hopefully going to keep reading Sinclair Ferguson's Some Pastors and Teachers. Right here sitting on my desk right now, I've got James Dolezal's book, All That Is in God, his book on classical theism. I also have Garnet Howard Milne's book, Has the Bible Been Kept Pure? The Westminster Confession of Faith and the Providential Preservation of Scripture. I've read about a third of it. It's excellent. And I'll be doing a Word magazine on that one and writing a review of it at some point. So anyways, I hope maybe it's been somewhat profitable, encouraging to share these reflections on the spiritual discipline of reading. Again, I don't share this in order to sort of promote myself. I'm not particularly exceptional by any means. And there are certainly people who are much better stewards of their time and energy than I am. But if you haven't taken up the discipline of reading, first, again, reading the scriptures. Secondly, though, reading other profitable books, Christian books, and even books by non-Christians. I would encourage you, as Sinclair Ferguson did, to pursue that, particularly if you're in the ministry. And of course, as Christians, and there's some sense in which we're all in the ministry. I'm talking about those of us who are called to hold office in the church, to be elders. I think it is important for us to be devoted to a life of study and a life of learning so that we can help other people spiritually through our preaching, through our teaching, through our personal counseling, through our example. So anyways, I hope that this has been helpful, and I certainly wish you God's richest blessings in the new year. Till the next Word magazine, take care and God bless.